You're listening to the FQXI podcast. Now, speaking of the holidays, astronomers are hoping for a huge present this year, as the world's largest space telescope is currently scheduled to launch, at the time of this recording, on Christmas Day. We'll be coming back to the telescope in a bit, but before we get to it, December is shaping up to be quite the month for cosmologists for another reason. As an added gift, a paper came out a couple of weeks ago which has served to deepen a cosmic puzzle over the age of the universe that has been brewing for some years. Astronomers have a number of different ways of measuring the so-called Hubble parameter, which is related to the rate of expansion of the universe, and in turn can be used to calculate just how long ago the Big Bang occurred. Over the years, all their experiments have been giving roughly the same value, leading to an estimate that our cosmos is about 13.8 billion years old. And astronomers expected that as they steadily improve their techniques, the measurements made by different experiments should get closer together, so they could settle on one value. But that hasn't happened. In fact, in December, the SHOES team, based at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, reported their latest estimate for the Hubble constant, made by observing the distance to special stars known as Cepheids. They found that their result differs significantly from estimates made by precise measurements of the relic radiation of the Big Bang, or the cosmic microwave background, using the Planck satellite. For the first time, this mismatch has reached, to use some technical jargon, a level of 5 sigma, which basically means it's too much to be dismissed as being down to chance. The difference in the age of the universe is now about a billion years. So what's behind the discrepancy? Is there some subtle effect in the way that these measurements are being made that has been overlooked? Or is this suggesting we need to rethink the standard model of cosmology, which is used to make some of the calculations? Science writer Mitch Waldrop has been following developments for some months, having just written a 60-page review of our best understanding of our cosmological origins. He joined me earlier to explain more about space telescopes and the tension over the Hubble parameter.
The Hubble parameter basically measures how fast the universe is expanding. This came to the fore in the 1920s when it was realized that galaxies are rushing away from us at a higher and higher velocity the further away they are. And the ratio of this recession velocity to the distance is the Hubble parameter. This is fundamental to understanding the age of the universe. The current best estimate taken from the cosmic microwave background is 13.8 billion years, but the SHOES result, based on the Cepheids, they get a higher Hubble parameter, which means a younger universe. So we're arguing not just about this obscure parameter, but about how old the universe actually is.
The SHOES team monitor the luminosity of special stars that vary in brightness called Cepheid variables, and also a certain kind of supernova called Type 1a. Their distance from Earth can be pinned down precisely based on these measurements, and that in turn can be used to calculate how fast the universe is expanding. But their result is quite different from the Planck team's, who looked at the cosmic microwave background. Might there be a problem with distances calculated using Cepheids?
That's a very interesting result. I mean, clearly the SHOES team has been as meticulous as humanly possible. They've done every cross-check anyone can think of. It's just a tour de force of careful observation. But the fact remains that doing distance with Cepheids, there are still lots of question marks. The problem is that as you go to more distant galaxies, it becomes harder and harder to separate individual Cepheid stars from the crowded stars around them. There are also questions about how much dust and so forth is in the way. The SHOES team has done meticulous work on trying to compensate for that, to understand that, to correct for it, but it is very, very hard to do.
Since Cepheids may be the issue, Other astronomers have investigated alternative ways to deduce distances out to far-flung regions of the cosmos. A third technique uses red giant stars rather than Cepheids. But that experiment has only served to deepen the mystery.
There was an earlier result this year from Wendy Friedman and her colleagues doing a very different type of calibration. It's called the tip of the red giant branch. And this relies not on oscillating stars, as the Cepheids do, but looking at the very brightest stars in the galaxies, the red giants that are at a certain phase of their expansion and of their life. And when they do this, they find a value for the Hubble constant that is actually intermediate between what you find using the Cepheid ladder that the SHOES team is finding and what you find from the cosmic microwave background as done from the Planck satellite. So we still have this problem. Nobody can find out exactly what, if anything, is wrong with the Cepheids. No one can find out what exactly, if anything, is wrong with the estimates of the Hubble parameter from the Planck results, the cosmic microwave background. It's still ambiguous.
There is another possibility. The estimate of the Hubble constant from the cosmic microwave background measurements uses the standard model of cosmology, also known as the Lambda CDM model. This model assumes a few things to be true: that cold dark matter exists, and that the unknown dark energy speeding up the expansion of the universe is caused by some energy of empty space called lambda. If that's wrong, maybe we need new physics to resolve the confusion.
The estimate from the cosmic ray background depends upon a very specific model of how the early universe evolved. That model is consistent with everything we see, everything we know. It's called the Lambda Cold Dark Matter model. It incorporates the late cosmic acceleration. It incorporates the dark matter that has become appreciated since the 70s and the 1980s. And is consistent with everything we know about the early universe. It's possible that this discrepancy was indicating some sort of fundamental physics, but it's, I think, still uncertain exactly how accurate the calibrations are, and there may be some extremely subtle issue with distances, or for that matter, with the cosmic model, one way or the other. We still haven't resolved that. So we don't know yet if it's fundamental physics or if it is some issue with calibration that are so subtle it's been very, very hard to find.
Now, Mitch, the reason I have you on the podcast today is because you have really been digging into all of these issues over many, many months. You've produced a report sponsored by the John Templeton Foundation, which FQXI produced. Basically, you're covering everything about cosmology from like the beginning of time to what we know today and the puzzles. But let me ask you, you know, were there any surprises for you? You're a very accomplished science writer. You've covered many of these issues before hundreds of times. What was the highlight for you?
Well, to me, it was the opportunity to really dig into the history of the subject. I have been covering astronomy and cosmology since about 1980. But whereas I knew the results of the findings from earlier work, like the fact that the universe is expanding, the fact that the universe began with what we now call the Big Bang, I didn't know how people had discovered it. What surprised me about this was how hard it was for even the professional astronomers and physicists and cosmologists to really come to terms with what they were seeing, because there was this deep-grained idea in the community as a whole that the universe was eternal. It was static, on average. Not only did people not accept that the universe was expanding, but even if they did, they had a very hard time accepting the consequence, which is, if you run the clock backwards, then all those galaxies must have been much closer together. They must have come from a common point. There must have been a beginning somewhere back there billions of years ago when everything was at the same place. And for decades, most astronomers didn't want to hear about it. They didn't want to think about a beginning for the cosmos, because how could you ever test it? This was unscientific. The origin of the universe was a realm of speculation for theology or philosophy or late-night dorm conversations, but it was not something for serious scientists to think about. As I point out in one of my chapters, the notion of a Big Bang, this violent, explosive creation of the universe from a single point, had to be rediscovered three times before the idea actually stuck. That's what was new to me. You think, you know, somebody discovers something, observes something, eureka, we found it, and everybody changes their mind. It doesn't work like that.
It was fascinating for me to read as well, even though I've got a background in cosmology, but some of the stories there, it was really illuminating. It's interesting that you brought up, at the time, people had a lot of difficulty accepting the Big Bang, and they felt that the origin of the universe was something that was a question for theology or metaphysics. It wasn't really a scientific question. There is a chapter in your report which deals with very much the same sort of issues around ideas at the moment about the multiverse. Some people love it. Listeners to our podcast will have heard about it a lot. Other people hate it. So you've gone into great detail about the reasons why it's a popular idea with some. And also you talk about sort of alternative models, because you acknowledge that it's not a popular idea with everyone. And so people are really still looking for rival theories. I'm not going to ask you too much about that, because I'm going to tell people to go away and, you know, have fun reading that chapter, because you get into a lot of really big theoretical ideas there. But let's come to this idea now of how people go around now actually looking for observational evidence for some of these ideas in astronomy, in cosmology. I'm going to bring you to, hopefully, fingers crossed, the launch of the world's biggest space telescope, which we're all waiting for. Tell me more about what's happening and what astronomers and cosmologists and astrophysicists are hoping to learn from this.
The James Webb Space Telescope is the successor to the Hubble Space Telescope. The Webb Space Telescope is a joint project of NASA, the European Space Agency, and the Canadian Space Agency. Planning started actually before Hubble was launched in 1990. This thing will be huge.
Yes, to give you some numbers, the telescope's primary mirror has a diameter of 6.5 meters compared to Hubble's 2.4 meters.
And then again, it will be able to gather much, much more light than Hubble, because it's just a bigger mirror. It will have much higher resolution, and it will be optimized to look in the deep infrared regions of the spectrum, much further than Hubble can go. When you see photographs of it, the mirror looks gold because of a special coating that is designed to optimize its sensitivity in the infrared. The reason you want to look deep into the infrared is because you want to look deep back into the very early universe, as far back as you can go, to see the first stars forming, to see the first galaxies forming. And because they're so far back, their light has been redshifted by the cosmic expansion to, you know, very long wavelengths.
Stretched by the expansion of the universe, basically, into the infrared.
It will also be able to get detailed spectra and maybe perhaps even images of some exoplanets, planets around other stars. It will do all manner of things. But in terms of cosmology, it will look back to the very earliest point of the universe when those first stars were forming out of the gas that emerged from the Big Bang itself.
Yeah, impressive stuff. Tell us something about how tough it is to get such a massive telescope into space.
This telescope will be a technological tour de force. The mirror is so big that it cannot be launched as a single piece. It would not fit inside any rocket fairing that exists. So in order to launch it, the mirror is built in hexagons on a frame supporting it, and it's actually folded like origami, inside the rocket. In any case, it will be launched on an Ariane rocket from South America. It will go up, not into Earth orbit, that's where Hubble is. It will go up beyond the Earth, beyond the Moon, to a point in space that's called L2, the second Lagrange point. And the significance of L2 is that if you were to draw a line between the Sun and the Earth and go a ways beyond it and take into account the orbital motion of the Earth and everything, this Lagrange point is where the gravitational forces of the Sun and the Earth just balance. So that if you put something there, it will stay there. This gets it away from the Earth and the infrared radiation that comes off the Earth, which would interfere with observations. The whole thing will need to unfold and everything lock into place. It will also deploy a Mylar sun shield. It'll be 5 separate layers of thin film that will always face the sun to block sunlight, so the super cold instruments will be able to operate with utmost sensitivity without interference from the heat of the sun. This Mylar sun shield is the size of a tennis court. And the thing about the L2 point is there is no space shuttle or any human-occupied spacecraft that can reach it. This thing has to work on its own, by itself, with no hope of being repaired if something doesn't work. So everybody's fingers are double and triple crossed here. This is a tremendous technological gamble. But if it works, it will be just unprecedented.
Thanks to Mitch Waldrop there. Here's hoping that the telescope does indeed launch as planned. And I know I'm biased, but if you are at a loss for how to spend the holidays, I would heartily recommend getting stuck into Mitch's report, linked to on the podcast page, fqxi.org/community/podcast. It's free, which is always a good thing, and it's a good long read to get stuck into at 60-odd pages, taking you through the history of cosmology in a very readable way, with some great historical anecdotes and all the latest observational results. At the end of the report, there's a chapter dedicated to the Hubble tension problem that we discussed at the top of our chat. As you can tell from our conversation, there are a great many intricacies about how these measurements are made. One great thing about the report is that in his early historical chapters, Mitch takes you right back to the earliest distance measurements and the measurements of the cosmic microwave background going back decades. So you can really get a deep sense of how exactly these precision measurements are made today, and maybe where they might be going wrong. The review also delves into the multiverse, the notion that our universe is only one of many, which I know is a favourite with our listeners, but it also covers alternative models, rainbow gravity, mirror universes, cyclic models, and more. On the podcast page, I'm also linking to an article that I wrote, inspired by Mitch's review, about hopes to test rainbow gravity models in the future.